Hi, my name is Elif Shafak, and I'm a storyteller, a writer, a novelist. My latest novel is called There Are Rivers in the Sky.
For this week's Marginalia, I spoke with Elif Shafak in anticipation of the paperback release of her novel, There Are Rivers in the Sky. The book follows three primary characters at three very different locations and dates, from ancient Nineveh to Victorian-era England to London and Iraq in 2018. A common thread throughout the book is actually a common drop, the many iterations of a single drop of water. I recently spoke with Elif Shafak about the novel, including how the Epic of Gilgamesh in part inspired the story, and the challenges of holding onto history. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Elif Shafak. There Are Rivers in the Sky was originally published in August of 2024, so we're speaking today ahead of the paperback release. Could you give our listeners a description of the book?
Thank you so much. So the way I see it, it's the story of three characters who might seem to be very different at first glance, but they are connected, hopefully in a surprising way. And then two rivers, which are the River Thames and the River Tigris in the Middle East, and one ancient poem, which is the Epic of Gilgamesh. So 3, 2, 1. And everything in this book is connected via a small, single drop of water.
As you mentioned, the book is made up primarily of, you know, these three alternating sections, which are marked as H, H, and O, like the chemical formula for water, H2O. And water is the common thread throughout, and the personification of a raindrop and the continuous memory of water. Water is life-bringing, but with human influence, it could also be life-taking. Can you talk about the quote-unquote memory of water and its significance throughout the book?
Indeed. And perhaps I should also say, maybe right away, that I am an author who comes from a part of the world where the scarcity of water is not some hypothesis or a theoretical question, but an acute reality. Today, out of the most 10 water-stressed nations in the world, 7 are in the Middle East and in North Africa. So what that means is our rivers are dying, they're drying up. And this, of course, has massive consequences for everyone, but particularly for women, for minorities, and for the poor. I think they're the ones who carry this burden in a very disproportionate way. And if I may give this example, usually in traditional communities, women happen to be water carriers, young women. And when there's no drinkable water nearby, the distance that a young woman has to walk increases, unfortunately also increasing the possibility for gender violence. And the reason I wanted to mention this is because in our minds, we put these things in separate boxes, like here's the drawer for climate crisis, here's the box for water scarcity, and then we open up another category for gender inequality or another for racial inequality and so on. But water reminds us that everything is connected. You know, there are no separate boxes, there are no drawers like that. And it reminds us that we are interconnected as human beings, not only with each other, with our fellow human beings, but also with nature. With regards to water memory, I also need to tell you that I was raised by a very traditional grandmother until I was 10 years old. And her world was full of superstitions, someone might call a very irrational world, you know, in which water had a voice, or trees would tell us something, or earth had a spirit, you know, you need to tread carefully, gently, and try to hear that voice. So for me, writing this book was perhaps an attempt to build a bridge between written culture and oral culture. And I found it fascinating that as I carried on doing research about water, I came across scientists who had been drawn to this idea of water memory. And I'm saying this in a cautious way, because I know this theory is still debated among the scientific community, and I'm not a scientist. But what drew me to this subject is passion. In other words, I'm interested in passion. What is it that makes human beings passionate? You know, it could be an archaeologist, a scholar, a scientist. What is it that makes them leave their comfort zones and search questions they might never find answers for. So water memory was interesting to me because it's something I've come across in oral culture of Middle East, the Balkans, Asia Minor, but then to find it as a hypothesis within the scientific community was an interesting coincidence.
I'm curious about your inspiration for the book because there were several storylines. How did the first story come about? Did one storyline, one of the timelines, jump out at you first? Where did you decide to begin this story?
So at first glance, this might seem to be an epic novel, epic in the sense that it does span countries and centuries and cultures. So when you look at it, the structure and the canvas of the novel is quite broad. It journeys across time and geography. But the interesting thing for me is that everything started with a very small idea. So I did not at the beginning start with a decision with a rational decision saying, okay, I'm going to journey across continents and centuries. I just followed this journey of a single drop, a drop of water. And actually, the way it started, I was walking by the River Thames one day and it started to rain. And one of these raindrops just landed on my palm. And I was looking at it, wondering if I can see its story. It's almost like a spiritual question. Perhaps it's the same question that William Blake asked when he wanted to see a whole world in a grain of sand. But the whole idea was we tend to take water for granted, and we should not. Today, when we talk about climate crisis, we are primarily talking about the story of water. And maybe sometimes in Europe we forget this because obviously all across the world sea levels are rising, but particularly in Europe and in America, of course, as well. Lately in Texas, sadly, in a heartbreaking way, you've had flash floods. So there are so many flash floods happening across the world, sometimes heavy rainfall plus sea levels rising. It gives us sometimes the impression that there's an abundance of water all around. But the paradox we're going through is within this abundance, there's water scarcity. So coming from the Middle East, I think a part of me also wanted to be able to say, I don't want to take even a drop of water for granted. But that drop brought me to the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is one of the oldest pieces of literature known in human history. And I think we have a lot to learn from this ancient poem, long narrative. Of course, in many ways, that poem is about water and the destruction that it can cause. And that poem brought me to an extraordinary Victorian scholar called George Smith. My fictional character is loosely based on him. I had to dream up a childhood, youth for him. But it could almost simultaneously, as soon as I had that character, I had the other characters as well. So it's not like I've written each section separately. But all three characters grew side by side. It was almost like braiding, weaving these three separate storylines.
Before we move on past water, I do want to note there's a table included after the book's conclusion, The Journey of a Drop of Water, which is absolutely fascinating. And it reminded me about this line from the novel, "Water is the consummate immigrant, trapped in transit, never able to settle." But you bring up the Epic of Gilgamesh. And while I was aware of it and own several translations, I have never actually read it. What should readers know about this poem before reading your novel?
Yeah, I really appreciate that we're talking about this because I think in this age, this poem has become all the more relevant, universally important. We're talking about a very ancient piece of literature, and we need to bear in mind that before it was written down thousands of years ago, before it was written down by scribes on clay tablets, it was transmitted via oral culture. So, grandmothers telling this story to grandchildren, which means the poem is much, much older than we assume. And for me, the interesting thing is, ever since this poem was told and then written down, imagine so many empires have come and gone, so many mighty kings have perished, and even the tallest architectural monuments have crumbled to dust. But a poem made of breath and a poem made of words, has survived. and it has survived the tides of history. Here we are, thousands of years later, still talking about it. This is a story about a very unlikely hero. I wouldn't even call him a hero because Gilgamesh, at the beginning of the story, is not a likable character at all. If anything, we would not like him, dislike him intensely. He does horrific things, and he's cruel. And it's only through journeys and friendship and loss and grief and defeat and failure that he comes back at the end of the poem. He's a better person. He's a wiser person. It's a story about going to other people's lands, taking their things. It's a story about friendship, journeys, our desire to prolong youth, our fear of death. So there's so many universally important themes in this epic, but it's also the story of water, the destruction, the flood, the abundance of water, and how human beings have destroyed their own lives when they have destroyed nature.
This line from your book refers to Gilgamesh. He did not see that the only way to become immortal is to be remembered after you've gone, and the only way to be remembered is to leave behind a good story. So I want to talk about oral tradition, because yes, this poem was passed on through oral tradition, but you also had Naren's grandmother recounting stories and recounting ancient old time stories for Naren. Can you talk a little bit about oral tradition, which, you know, more recent oral tradition?
So, as we mentioned earlier, I have three main characters in this book, and the way I see them, they're like atoms in a water molecule, like the H2O. And depending on which character we're following, the style changes a little bit, because I think every story demands its own style. So the part where I talk about the Victorian character has a much more Dickensian tone, if I may put it in these words. The part where I talk about the water sciences is more contemporary literature. But when we talk about the third character, which is a Yazidi girl living in Turkey in an ancient settlement called Kastrum Kefa or Hasan Cave, that part has more dialogue in it because the Yazidi community, so she comes from the Yazidi background. And as you know, the Yazidis are one of the most misunderstood, maligned, and persecuted minorities in the world. This is a culture that mostly relies on oral storytelling. So they don't have a written book, sacred book, which means collective memory is passed on via ballads, folk tales, lullabies, riddles, and songs, and so on. The Yazidi lore talks about 72 massacres throughout history, date by date, keeping the memory. So they have been persecuted in the most horrific ways. And of course, the 73rd massacre and genocide happened in front of the eyes of the world in 2014, when ISIS fanatics launched a campaign of destruction and violence against vulnerable communities in the Middle East. And maybe not many people noticed at the time that the very first thing that the extremists did was to kill the water. So they poisoned the fountains, they poisoned the wells and the streams, leaving no drinkable water for entire communities. And the second thing they did, in my opinion, in a very calculated way, was to kill the elderly. In a community like the Yazidis, if you kill the older generations, you're killing collective memory. If you kill collective memory, you kill collective identity. And then they killed defenseless men, and they kidnapped women and children. Now, 10 years later, more than 10 years, we're speaking right now, there are still more than 3,000 Yazidi women missing. Unfortunately, they've been turned into sex slaves, treated in the most despicable, horrific ways. Purely by coincidence, while I was writing this novel, one of these women was saved in a house, from a house in Ankara, in the neighborhood where I grew up, my maternal grandmother's house, literally a few streets away. And that hit me very hard because I was doing research at the time. We're talking about a very tight-knit community. How is it possible that a human being is kept under these horrific circumstances in a house, in a tight-knit community, in an ordinary neighborhood, and the neighbors don't know, or the neighbors don't see, or they don't talk about it? So I think there's a numbness or indifference or dehumanization that is still part of this big problem.
I'd like to talk about the book's dedication and how it might relate to one theme throughout the book, the roles of women in history and science and art. And it reads, "To a beloved writer who, when asked to speak about women in fiction, sat down by the banks of a river and wondered what the words meant. Can you talk a bit about your female characters and how they fit into the worlds around them? I mean, I ask this while thinking about another line from the book. Women are expected to be like rivers, readjusting, shape-shifting. And also these lines. Naren knows that whenever there is a memorial gathering, it is an elder female who must lead the way. Mourning is a woman's job, and so is remembrance."
Yeah, I really appreciate. I do observe immigrant families a lot on both sides of the Atlantic, but not only immigrant families, any family that comes from a complex, multi-layered background. And it always amazes me to see how different generations respond to memory and forgetting. So usually in such families, it's the older generations who have gone through the biggest hardships. But that does not necessarily mean they talk about the past. In fact, they do not. They do not even know how to talk about the past, which doesn't mean they have forgotten it. It just sits inside their chest, unspoken, all those words. The second generation is usually, and broadly speaking, they're not that interested in the past. They don't have the time or the energy for it, understandably, because they need to build a new life. Tabula rasa, they have to be forward-looking, future-oriented. They need to find their feet. But that leaves the third or the fourth generations in these families, the youngest in these families, who I believe are today the ones who are asking the deepest questions about ancestral heritage, not only family stories, but also family silences. And I think in every family, there's at least one memory keeper. There might be four siblings, but only one of them does the memory keeping. I would like to hope and believe that writers are memory keepers of their societies, of their eras. What I observe as I travel across countries is that women also do a lot of memory keeping, you know, and they want to understand those silences. I am interested in strong female characters, but that doesn't mean my characters always succeed in everything. It doesn't mean they're always happy. There is no such thing. It doesn't mean they're perfect. None of us are. But what intrigues me is how we have to recreate ourselves. As immigrants, we have to learn to do that. As women, we have to learn to do that. And so that's an important theme for me, silences and stories, but also our ability as human beings for renewal.
This might be a good time to point out the dedication at the end of the novel. "Now and always, praise be to Nisaba." Can you talk about this dedication?
Thank you so much. Earlier, I mentioned that I was very interested in silences. I think when you're a writer, you're not only drawn to stories, but also a part of me tries to understand where are the silences, the buried stories or the buried rivers. And one of those silences is about a goddess, the goddess of writing. In the Middle East, as we go back in time, thousands of years back, it makes a lot of sense that a female deity represented both agriculture, harvests, soil, and literature, literacy, and libraries. Why? Because we do know that the writing system was needed as human beings cultivated the soil, and the more they were able to settle down and agriculture developed, the bigger the need for an alphabet and for numbers and for a system of memory keeping. So it was a female goddess that represented all those skills. But as time goes by and patriarchy becomes more and more consolidated, what we realize is Nisaba's talents are one by one transferred to a male god called Nabu. So early on in many scribal schools, students would end their tablets by saying, "Praise be to Nisaba." But there comes a moment when they start saying, "Praise be to Nabu." And it's very interesting to me that in the drawings, Nisaba is now, after this transformation, Nisaba is portrayed not as a goddess anymore, but as the dedicated, devoted, and loving wife of God Nabu. And then time goes by and Nisaba is not the wife anymore, but she's the secretary, the hardworking secretary of male god Nabu. And then time goes by, and Nisaba is completely erased out of history. Whereas the cult of Nabu continues in a way because it continues to influence both Roman and Greek mythology. So there are similarities with many other Roman and Greek gods and Nabu, but Nisaba completely is forgotten and erased. And I think a part of me wanted to remember her, and that's why my novel finishes with that dedication, praise be to Nisaba.
There was a line in the text that has haunted me in a way. It was in a section talking about museums, determining what is worth preserving for posterity. Within its walls, history is not only being protected and displays, but also rewritten. In deciding what will be remembered, a museum, any museum, is also deciding in part what will be forgotten. Can you talk about this?
Yes, I was very interested while I was writing this book in the history of modern museums. There's a moment in time when museums stop serving as warehouses and they become the hubs for national memory, you know? And in a way, as they decide what to display, they also decide what not to display. So that connection between memory, forgetting, what is shown in which way, you know, there's maybe a hierarchy in the way in which things, objects are being presented. There's a lot to question there. There's also a lot of value. I love museums and I find them very important. However, I think there are some major questions that our museums need to engage with. Who gets to tell the story of the past and who is not invited to the table to talk about that story? For instance, I say this as a writer who comes from Turkey, a country with a very long and rich history, but that doesn't necessarily translate into strong memory. If anything, I think in Turkey we're a society of collective amnesia. So, for instance, when I look at the way history is being taught to us at school, it's mostly his story, meaning the stories of a few men in positions of power and authority, like sultans or Sheikhulislams, which were men at the top of the religious hierarchy. But the moment you start asking questions like, what about the stories of women? There's a big silence. What was the Ottoman Empire like for an Armenian silversmith, or a Jewish miller, or an Arab peasant, a Kurdish farmer, a Greek sailor? What was the empire like for them? There's a big silence. So I find those silences important, and I think museums need to engage in that conversation. Today, when I look at the British Museum, which is the one museum that I focused on a lot in this book, there are so many artifacts under that roof brought over from the Middle East, particularly in this case from Iraq. And I think it's not enough for our museums to say, well, our doors are open to everyone. Anyone who wants to see them can come and visit. That is not enough. How many people can even afford a visa? How many people can make this journey? So we have to find new creative way forward. We need to be able to talk about some uncomfortable truths. For instance, we rarely recognize the fact that when these artifacts were brought over, first of all, was it right for people to take these artifacts and bring them over? That is an important question that needs to be asked. And also, along the way here, so many artifacts were damaged, you know, stolen. And we don't talk about that. At the bottom of the River Tigris, there are Lamassu sculptures. There are clay tablets. Why? Because they sank while they were being transferred. So we need to unpack all those realities, you know, the facts from history. But as I'm talking about this, as a Turkish and British writer, I also need to talk about the Ottoman authorities. What were they doing at the time? The negligence, the ignorance, the destruction of culture. And then there's another layer, which is ISIS, the destruction of cultural artifacts in the most barbaric way by ISIS militants in both Syria and Iraq. But as they were shooting these videos and showing it to the world, behind closed doors, they were smuggling artifacts and making enormous amounts of money out of this. So there was an illicit trafficking of cultural artifacts to such an extent that at some point on London's Portobello Road, on stalls, you could see artifacts brought over on the street from Syria and Iraq. So this is a very complicated story that we're talking about. And I think one of the many reasons why I love the novel in particular, literature so much, is because inside a novel, there's room for nuance and pluralism and diversity. You can ask difficult questions and leave the answers to the reader. We might be very critical of colonial institutional history, but at the same time, appreciate the efforts of individual archaeologists or scholars like George Smith, who passionately dedicated their lives to finding a poem or the missing lines of a poem. So you can do multiple things and talk about this very complicated subject in a calm, nuanced, and hopefully in a wiser way inside a novel. I don't think social media is the right place to discuss these issues.
I both read and listened to the book, and audiobook listeners might miss out on the incorporation of a few photos of artifacts in the book, particularly of the Lamassu. How did you decide when and where to incorporate these images?
Usually inside literary fiction, we don't come across pictures. And I'm so glad that with my publishers, both with Knopf and Penguin UK, we decided to keep a few pictures, images inside this novel. And I'm glad we did it because it felt so right, organically so, because one of my main characters is a Victorian era scholar. And of course, once upon a time inside novels, it was quite usual to have pictures and images. As time went by, we separated these worlds, particularly the pictures of Lamassu sculptures. They're incredible. Or the moment when they're being brought into the British Museum for the first time, we're talking about gigantic sculptures here that weigh tons, you know? They're part human, part bird, and part lion or bull. Impressive, impressive creatures. They were the guardian spirits of important buildings in ancient Assyria, including the Library of Ashurbanipal. So there were some images that we wanted to keep because those pictures were so precious. And also it was like continuing this old literary tradition that we have abundant in 19th century. I like it when books have images inside.
As we mentioned, the book covers several timelines from olden times to 2018. And some of the more recent inclusions in the book were, as we discussed, the 2014 genocide of the Yazidi by ISIS and a look at organ trafficking. And then there were subjects that felt not only timely, but also timeless. The library is under threat, mental illness, flooding, as you just mentioned. Does it feel like we're just in a vicious cycle with these topics?
I think it's an illusion to believe that time is linear, to hope that tomorrow will always be more advanced than yesterday. In fact, there's no such guarantee. We want to believe that the arc of history will bend towards justice, but there's no guarantee for that either. And I think when we look at nature and the way we have mistreated nature, it makes us question, is there such a thing as linear history? If I may give you an example, when I look at the Thames River, which so deeply, profoundly shapes London and life in the UK, we're talking about a zombie river. Zombie because not that long ago it was declared biologically dead. Why? Because of the way we human beings have mistreated the river to such an extent that it was full of filth and sewage. And at some point it was concluded that no biospecies could ever survive in such a filthy river. But here we are, 150 years later, and the Thames has renewed itself. It is so beautiful, and it's home to hundreds and hundreds of biospecies. But instead of admiring, respecting what the river has done, has achieved, instead of doing that, what we are doing is quite the opposite. As we're speaking right now, water companies in the UK, in the name of money or profit and greed, in my opinion, they're pumping sewage back again into our beloved rivers. Not investing in infrastructure and pumping sewage back into rivers. So it makes you question, even when you follow the journey of one river Are we really learning anything from history? Or we have this illusion of, linear progressive time, but there is no such thing. And I think we have become very arrogant as human beings. We think we are the cleverest of species. We have turned ourselves into consumers of nature, but we're not above nature. We're not outside nature. We're only a small part of a very, very delicate ecosystem. And I think we have to rethink our entire connection with nature.
While this is a work of fiction, you blended this fiction with fact, including characters like Charles Dickens. Can you talk about building a fictional story around some of these real people? I mean, in your note to the reader, you mentioned deviating from fact on occasion. Have readers skipped your note and taken you to task at all?
Well, I think in the English language, it's a little bit unfortunate that we use the word fiction as if it were the opposite of fact. I think fiction is very interested in truth, and fiction, in fact, brings us closer to truth, but it does it in its own way, in a very gentle, profound, but important way. I love interdisciplinary thinking. I love it when we dare to leave our comfort zones and become students of another discipline. As a novelist, I don't know anything about neuroscience or water science, but if the story takes me in that direction, I'm ready to learn and I want to learn. I like it when a scientist falls in love with poetry, or when a poet becomes interested in film theory, or when a director is drawn to philosophy. The moment we journey into other disciplines, and in a world in which we're constantly atomized or pushed into boxes, we're not encouraged to think in an interdisciplinary way. But again, the novel as a genre is so flexible and fluid. There's room for it. You can weave reality and with the more fantastical, almost spiritual elements of life. I'm not very fond, to be honest, with the term magical realism, only because it supposes two separate worlds, like here's the world for magic and here's the world for reality. But when you live in a city like Istanbul, for instance, Istanbul is not a city that separates things into, mutually exclusive zones. It doesn't say, well, here's the neighborhood for the West, here's the neighborhood for the East. It doesn't say this is the box for humor, there's the box for sorrow. Or this is the street for modernity, this is the street for traditions. What it does is it blends everything in the most chaotic but creative ways sometimes. So in Istanbul, you might come across a very sad scene, but underneath there's an element of absurd. Or you might come across something so funny, but underneath there's so much melancholy. What I'm trying to say is even the most ordinary moments in life, there is magic, there's poetry. So for me, the novel is always interdisciplinary by nature, but we're not encouraged to write in this way. When you read Virginia Woolf's Orlando and imagine, I mean, she wrote it early on, that is a very fluid novel. It surpasses, it goes beyond, transcends boundaries of time, geography, identity, and so on. So for me, all I'm trying to say is personally, the novel symbolizes freedom.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from this book?
I'm very touched by the fact that my readership is so diverse. Maybe people who won't necessarily break bread together, or breathe the same air. The very fact that they're reading the same novels and connecting with similar characters, that really means a lot to me in a world in which we're so polarized, in a world that is bitterly, bitterly politicized. However, I also want to tell you that as a writer, I don't like it when writers try to preach something or teach something or lecture. I find that very, very off-putting. I don't know the answers myself. The only thing I know is there are questions that I care about. I genuinely care about the questions that I'm trying to open up. So if I can create a space of freedom, if I can hold a space for diversity, multiplicity, and nuance, and then if I can take a step back and leave the answers to the reader, I think that's the right way forward because every reader is going to come up with their own answers. No two readings are ever the same. You know, our readings are unique, like our fingerprints. I've met couples who have been married for 45 years. They read the same novel. One of them loves it, the other one not so much. Or I've met friends who share everything, every little secret. They read the same novel, but they feel connected to completely different characters. So my point is, the reader is not passive. Every reader brings their own gaze, their own story into the novel, and I have to respect that. But if I may say this, this book has been received so warmly by readers, librarians, booksellers from so many, you know, different corners of the world. I have met people who have tattoos on their arms inspired by the sign of water in this book, or have tattooed lines from this novel. And all of that is incredibly precious for me. As a writer, you're very lonely. You know, the particularly novelists, we're very solitary creatures. We're introverts. You're on your own for weeks, for months, for years when you're creating a novel. And the very fact that when it's out and when it, you know, starts its own journey, that book reaches people you will never get to meet. And that book means something to these people. We might come from very different backgrounds, but we have so much, you know, our shared humanity. It brings us all back to that shared humanity and reminds us that Storyland is our home, our shared home. So all of that gives me hope.
Well, the book is There Are Rivers in the Sky. Alif Shafak, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Alif Shafak, author of the book There Are Rivers in the Sky, which was published by Vintage. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.